Hi folks, how are you? Any questions before we start? And let me ask you a question. I sent that email out. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I sent that email out about the quiz being on the 20th, and then somebody said that on the website for the class it said the 27th. There is a 27th quiz for the MBA evaluation class. So I don't know whether somehow something got mixed up, because I with six classes, who knows what I linked up to. Does it say the 27th on this class's webpage? You have any idea what I'm talking about, the third quiz? Anybody? It says the 20th, okay. I have no problem moving it later if it need be, because it's online now. It doesn't really matter when you take it. So let me check, you know what, I'll send out a Google survey to see whether there's some consensus on moving it to the 22nd or the 27th. I think it's better to get it done earlier because there'll be less material. But as I said, I am, you know, I'm pretty flexible on it, but I know I will figure out a way, because I don't want to ask it during a Zoom session. It's incredibly chaotic. So, you know, it'll happen. Any other questions before we start? I'm sorry about your DCFs and not getting them back to you. I've been incredibly crazy. It's I haven't even had a chance to get through more. I've gone through like 50 so far out of the 600. So I've got like 550 DCFs waiting for me. And I hope to get through them tomorrow and day after, God willing. So no, you should be getting them soon. I won't say more than that. Okay, we're at time, so I'm going to get started. Last week, we were talking about price-earnings ratios and price-to-book ratios. We're talking about multiples in general. We're talking about controlling for differences. So let me review again. When you're looking at the price-earnings ratio, there are three variables that drive the price-earnings ratio. Risk through the cost of equity, growth, you know, through earnings growth, and the payout ratio, or conversely, the return equity, because the two are linked up. So when you look at a stock and it has a low PE ratio, your first test is to see, is it a risky stock? Then you look at, is it a really low growth stock? Then maybe it's a low return equity stock. You're looking for a reason for the PE ratio. So use that tool, because now I'm going to play the role of the naive analyst again. I'm going to present you with the PE ratios for a bunch of emerging markets. This is a very old example, but kind of let's stick it. So I've got a bunch of emerging markets. I've got the PE ratio for each of them. I also have interest rates, real growth, and country risk for each of these markets. Now, in June of 2000, if I decided to just buy the market with the lowest PE ratio, it's easy, right? Turkey is the cheapest market. So let's say I'm the analyst. I say, put all your money in Turkey. It looks cheap. Tell me what I might be missing by focusing just on the P ratio. Look at the three variables I've given you and tell me what it is about Turkey that might explain the low P ratio. Anybody? What is it about Turkey that makes it have a low P ratio? What is the fundamental that's
the risk?
One is the risk, which is pretty high, not as risky as Indonesia then, but still risky. And what's the other? How growth drives PE? It had one of the lowest growth rates in 2000. So it's low growth, then high risk, and maybe that explains the PE ratio. And here's the problem with storytelling. You can go on the one hand, on the other hand, on the third hand, the fourth hand. By the time you get the seventh hand, you've completely lost track of which hand is holding what. So I'm going to go back to my statistics class and draw on a technique for controlling for differences. In statistics, you often have a dependent variable you're trying to explain. In this case, it's PE ratio. And there are three things that worry me here. One is the level of interest rates. If interest rates go up, PE ratio should go down. The second is growth in GDP. The higher that number is, the higher the PE ratio should be. And finally, if risk is high, the PE ratio should be low. I ran a regression. When you run a regression, it takes the data. It summarizes the data with a regression equation. So these are not numbers I estimate. They're output from the regression. Let's read the regression and see what it's telling us. The base, 16.16, tells you very little. It's what I'm going to build off. Minus 7.94 times interest rates. What does that tell me? As interest rates go up, PE ratios decrease. Plus 154.4 times growth in GDP. The higher the growth rate, the higher the PE ratio. That makes sense. And the higher the risk, the lower the PE ratio. The R squared was 73%. Now, this is a little deceptive because my sample is small and the R squareds can get pulled up because I have a couple of variables that pull the R squared up, but it's a pretty decent regression. Now, the question is, can I use that regression to decide whether Turkey should be where I put my money or somewhere else? So here's what I did. I went back to the previous page. I have the interest rates, growth, and country risk for each country, right? I plug those numbers into the regression. So if I take Argentina and I plug in Argentina's interest rate, Argentina's growth in GDP, Argentina's country risk, I come up with the PE ratio. So CS was the input normalized? No, I just took the actual PE ratio. So there's nothing to normalize here because you're trying to predict the actual PE. I get a predicted PE for Argentina. That predicted PE for Argentina was 13.57. You're saying, what does that tell me? Given the interest rates, growth, and country risk of Argentina, I would predict that the PE ratio should be 13.57. Its actual PE ratio is 14. What does that make it? It makes Argentina slightly overpriced. Given its fundamentals, it should be really at 13.57. It's trading at 14. You see what I'm trying to do? I'm trying to come up with a predicted PE ratio for every company given its fundamentals. So you look at Turkey, if I plug in the interest rate, growth, and risk, I come up with 13.35. It is slightly undervalued, but not by as much as I thought it was by just looking at the PE ratio. Can you update this to today? Absolutely. In fact, you have much richer data. The reason I haven't done is I've been too lazy, but if you downloaded the PE ratios for 30 markets, which you can now on S&P Capital IQ, and then you downloaded measures that you think drive that PE ratio. Remember, it's growth, risk, and return equity. Something correlate with those. You should be able to do exactly what I did in 2000 and tell me which markets look cheap and which markets look expensive. See, what am I going to do with that? If I'm a global portfolio manager, I want to direct my money to the cheaper markets and away from the markets that are overvalued. It's a very simple process for pricing markets relative to each other. So any questions on what I did here? So basically I took, just like in the first example where I just looked at the graph, I went back past just looking at the PE ratios and asking questions about, can I explain differences in PE ratios across companies? So no questions? So let's move on to a third example. One, in the S&P 500 is the most tracked and followed index in the world. And there are market strategies. Yesterday, the Goldman strategist was out, David Kostin, and he was saying, I think stocks will go down. The day before that, it was the JP Morgan market strategist. I think stocks will go up. I'll be quite honest. I think market strategists are a waste of time and space, but they have no idea what's going on. They just act like they do. But one of the tools that market timers use is to look at what a market is trading at relative to its history. So I'll give you a very simple measure that a lot of market timers use. They look at the PE ratio for the entire market. So this is the S&P 500. I've computed a bunch of different PE ratios. So let me list out the PE ratios I've computed. The blue line is the actual PE ratio. Okay? So that's just price divided by trailing earnings. The second line is called the normalized PE ratio. You see, what's a normalized PE ratio? I divide the price today by the average earnings over the last 10 years. I'm normalizing earnings. The third is called the CAPE. It's basically a PE ratio which adjusts for, it adjusts for the normalized earnings and inflation. And there's a Shiller PE, which does something very similar. Now, I know that all these PE ratios get thrown at you, but look at what they all do. They move together. I think a lot of this inventing and reinventing PE ratios just make it look like you've done something sophisticated. But using all of the different measures of the PE ratio, here's what I have. I have the PE ratio right at the start of 2020. And you can compare those numbers to what they were in the last decade, the decade before that, or go all the way back 50 years. So I'll play the role of somebody who thinks about it. So this is before the crisis. I come to you and I say, you know what, stocks are overpriced. And here's what my basis for that is. The PE ratio today is much higher than it's been historically. That's technically true, right? The PE ratio at the start of 2020 was much higher than it's been for the most part across history. So what's wrong with that sales pitch? What am I missing when I say stocks are expensive just because their PE ratios are higher? Anybody want to try? It's actually been the weakest link in their argument is actually a very simple one. So why can't I just say if the PE ratio is higher than the historical norm, then stocks are overvalued. I don't have to use a formula to get the for the previous predicted PE, I just use the regression equation. So if you go back, then Austin had a question about what formula I used. It's not a formula, it's a regression output. It's a regression equation based on what those countries were trading at. But in this particular S&P 500 PE ratio, why can't I jump to the conclusion just by looking at the PE ratio?
Because you have to look at other opportunities to invest, for example.
Actually, let's pause it. What's my, if I don't invest in stocks, what's the most obvious alternative that people invest in?
Bonds.
Bonds. And what's happened to interest rates over the last 10 years?
They've declined.
They've declined. Therein lies the catch with people saying, hey, PE ratio is high today, therefore stocks are overpriced. So here's what I did. I decided to bring interest rates into the equation. Okay. So here's what I computed. You know what the PE ratio for stocks is, right? It's a index level divided by the earnings for the index. I computed a PE ratio for a bond. You're saying PE ratio for a bond? I took the price of the bond and divided by the yield, right? That's like a PE ratio. And if you do that, you actually can see that the brown line is the PE ratio for bond. So I'll make a counter pitch. I'll say, no, stocks are not expensive, they're cheap. If you compare them to the PE ratio for bonds, because that's your comparison. And for the last decade, this has been the biggest issue. You can't compare PE ratios across time without bringing in the fact that interest rates today are much lower than they've been historically. Now, neither of these graphs answers that question, no? And Will, I have no idea what you're typing, but get your hands off the keyboard because strange things are happening, you know? So here's what I did. I inverted the PE ratio. It's called the earnings yield. It's a widely used measure, again, by market strategists. The earnings yield here is basically this blue line. I also put in the T-bond rate into the same graph. Let me pause right there. Do you think the two seem to move together? The earnings to price ratio, which is the earnings yield, and the T-bond rate seem to move together for much of the last 50 years, right? I also graphed out a third series, which is the difference between the T-bond rate and the T-bill rate. This measures the slope of the yield curve. When that number is a high number, you got an upward sloping yield curve. When that number is close to zero, you got a flat yield curve. And when that number is negative, you actually have a downward sloping yield curve. Short-term rates are higher than long-term rates. You see, who cares? This seems to be an effect of the yield curve on both PE ratios and on T-bond rates. So basically, I have three different series here. And I wanted to figure out whether I could use these series to make a judgment on are stocks correctly priced today. So here's what I did. Again, I opened up my statistics book. And I said, you know what? I can look at the correlation between earnings to price ratios and T-bond rates. And guess what? They're very highly correlated. When T-bond rates are high, the earnings to price ratio is high. Remember, the earnings to price ratio is high, the price earnings ratio is low. So as T-bond rates go up, PE ratios will come down. And there is a negative correlation between earnings to price ratios and the slope of the yield curve. You said, why would that be? I don't know whether you've heard of this rule of thumb, which is if the yield curve gets downward sloping, what does it predict? I mean, in fact, in the last couple of years, people often have freaked out. Oh my God, the yield curve is downward sloping. What does a downward sloping yield curve supposedly signal? What are people worried about? Connor says a recession. That's exactly right. So a downward sloping yield curve has become associated with the recession. See, why should it affect P ratios? What happens to growth during the recession? It decreases, right? So what you get here is when you have a downward sloping yield curve, your growth is going to come down. If your growth comes down, your price earnings ratio would reflect it. So you're seeing an intuitive connection here. As T bond rates go up, earnings to price ratios will go up. As the yield curve gets flatter, downward sloping, earnings to price ratios will come down. So I decided to run a regression again. Now, I have the statistics book open, might as well try it out, right? So I ran a regression of earnings to price ratios. This is for the S&P 500 across time. This is called a time series regression against the T-bond rate each year and the difference between the T-bond rate and the T-bill rate. It looks like the slope, that T-bond rates, the slope doesn't do much for earnings to price ratios anymore. The T-statistic is minus 0.8. Does anybody remember how you look at a T? Those are T-statistics down there. Does anybody remember what the rule of thumb is when you run a regression about a t-statistic in a regression? What does it have to be for significance? If it's greater than 2, Will is actually right, 1.962. If you get t-statistics above 2, you have strong significance. If it's between 1.5 and 2, you have significance. And if it drops below 1, might as well take it out. So it looks like t-bond rates and t-bill rates are no longer explaining much. But the difference between T-bond and T-bill rates, but T-bond rates by themselves are very strongly related to earnings price ratios. Incidentally, I have to tell you that I've been running this regression now for about 25 years. Every year I update the data. And if I compare what we have today to what used to be the case in 2008, first, notice the R-squareds have dropped. And second, in 2008, the slope of the yield curve was actually marginally significant. Over time, the relationship between interest rates and price earnings ratios has become weaker, especially post-2008. But there's still significance in that relationship. So now let's suppose I came to you and said, can you now tell me whether stocks are overpriced or underpriced? Can somebody tell me how I could perhaps use this equation to answer that question of whether stocks are underpriced or overpriced today? What could I do? What's the T-bond rate today? Does anybody know off the top of their head? I think it was like 0.65 or 0.7%, 0.7%. You could plug in today's T-bond rate. The T-bill rate today is about 0.03%. Let's say I plug in today's T-bond rate and today's T-bill rate into this regression. I get a predicted earnings to price ratio for the S&P 500, right? I can compare that predicted earnings to price ratio to the actual earnings to price ratio. What is that going to tell me? Given T-bond rates and T-bill rates today, this is what my earnings to price ratio should be, but this is what it actually is. That comparison is going to let me decide whether given interest rates being where they are stocks cheap or expensive? For the last decade, that's what I would have done. Rather than look at the P ratio and say that number looks low, therefore stocks are cheap. Or that number looks high, therefore stocks are expensive. So coming out of this particular crisis, watch out for the market strategists. They're going to say some really weird stuff, often based on data that doesn't exist. Check it against the data. You now have the capacity to take a David Costin. He might be Goldman Sachs market strategist, but he's not God. So when he says, I think the S&P 500 could go to 2100, check it through the numbers. You have the capacity to double check these numbers. Any questions? Okay, so let's move on to a second multiple. It's called the PEG ratio. If you've never heard of the PEG ratio, it's a variant of the PE ratio. Here's what you do. You take the PE ratio for a stock and you divide by the expected growth in earnings per share. You're saying, what are you talking about? Let's say you have a stock with a PE ratio of 20. And its expected growth in earnings for the next 5 years is 10%. You divide 20 by 10, your PEG ratio is 2. You know what analysts are looking for? They're looking for a low PEG ratio. Low PEG ratio is supposed to reflect a cheap stock. It's just a quick and lazy way of saying, look, you know, if I have high growth stocks, I expect the PE ratios to be high, but I want to invest in high growth stocks. This allows you to invest in high growth stocks. The origins of this multiple go back to the 1970s when Peter Lynch built up the Fidelity Magellan Fund. Now, Peter Lynch was a legendary portfolio manager for Fidelity. He built up the Fidelity Magellan from nothing into the largest growth mutual fund in the world. And he said the way he picked stocks was he couldn't pick based on low P/E ratios because he could never find a growth stock. He said he brought growth into his decision process. He wrote a book that people took the book, and from that book was born PEG ratio and all the variants thereof. And when analysts use PEG ratios, their argument is I can now compare companies with very different growth rates and still be able to find cheap companies because I'm controlling for growth when I use PEG ratios. In other words, they're telling you when you use a PEG ratio, you don't have to worry about differences in growth anymore. Is that true though? So to answer that question, here's what I did. I went back to that two-stage dividend discount model I developed. Remember in the last session, I used it for the PE ratio. And then I did the algebra. I divided both sides by the earnings and then by the growth. I ended up with an equation for the PEG ratio. I know this looks incredibly messy, but here's the thing I want you to ask. Remember the sales pitch for PEG ratios? If you do PEG ratios, growth is no longer an issue. Hey, when you look at the equation, growth seems to be an issue. In fact, it's all over the place. It's in the numerator, it's in the denominator. The relationship between PEG and growth rate has now become incredibly messy. And that's often the case when people take shortcuts. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the PEG ratio and I'm going to use it and I'm going to talk about it primarily in the context of if I'm using PEG ratios to pick stocks, what should I watch out for? So here's the first thing that comes looking at that equation. Riskier stocks, so remember risk pushes up your cost of equity. Riskier stocks should have lower PEG ratios than safer stocks. So if you're comparing two stocks with the same growth rate and one is riskier, I would expect the riskier stock to have the lowest PEG ratio. Why? Because higher risk makes the value of growth smaller. And dividing PE by the growth rate doesn't neutralize it. It makes it go all over the place. It makes it a complete mess. Now, no, talking in abstractions doesn't help. So what I did was I went back to that very simple company that I used earlier for the PE ratio. Remember 25% growth for the next 5 years, 8% thereafter, payout ratio of 20% for the next 5 years, 50% thereafter. I plugged in the numbers into the PEG ratio equation and I came up with a PEG ratio of 1.15 for this company. Again, you might say, well, what does that tell me? If this company were priced fairly, given its intrinsic value to be traded, its PEG ratio would be 1.15. Already you can see it that a rule of thumb that some people use is false. One rule of thumb that you will see used by analysts who use the PEG ratio is they argue that a PEG ratio less than one means you're cheap. I have no idea where they came up with this rule. It's definitely not true because this stock is going to be trading at 1.15 times with a PEG ratio 1.15 and it's trading at a fair value. So get rid of that simple rule of thumb. But let's go further. Let's ask some what if questions just like we did with the PE ratio. First ask, what will happen to the PEG ratio if holding all its constant in that example, I raise the risk. No surprises here. Across the board, no matter what growth rate I have for the first 5 years, as my stock gets riskier, its PEG ratio decreases. Riskier stocks will have lower PEG ratios than safer stocks. Put simply, if I compare the PEG ratio for tech companies, it should be lower than the PEG ratio for the S&P 500. Not because tech companies are cheap, but because they're riskier. I also looked at what would happen to the PEG ratio if you had a higher payout ratio, if your return equity were high. Again, no surprises. Holding all its constant, if you're a more efficient deliverer of growth, if you have higher returns in equity, your PEG ratios will increase. So higher risk lowers your PEG ratio, higher return equity increases your PEG ratio. I then asked, what will happen to the PEG ratio as the growth rate changes and things become really messy? Initially, as I increase my growth rate, PEG ratios decrease and then they bottom out and they start increasing again. And this is what makes PEG ratios so difficult to work with. Let me explain. If I ask you to find a cheap stock based on the PE ratio, I'm going to go through a list of things. You tell me what you would want in a cheap stock. You want a low PE, obviously. You want low growth or high growth if it's a cheap stock? You have low PE, what are you looking for? Low growth or high growth? You don't want anything that explains away the low PE, so you want high growth. Right? You want low risk or high risk? You want low risk because high risk explains away the PE ratios. You want low PE, high growth, low risk. You want low return on equity or high return equity? You want a high return equity. So you want a stock with low PE, high growth, low risk, and a high return equity. You're saying, what chance do I have of finding something like that? Hey, no harm looking. You have access to S&P Capital IQ. Why don't you run some screens? You want to look for stocks with a PE ratio less than 10, a growth rate higher than 15%, a beta below 1, and a return equity higher than 15%. See what you get? I think that's the basis for screening. But with PEG ratios, things get messier. When I want you to find a cheap stock with a PEG ratio, I want a low PEG ratio. I want low risk, obviously, because high risk explains over. So I want low PEG ratio, low risk. I want a high return on equity. When I ask you what kind of growth you want, take a look at that graph. It's going to be very difficult. PEG ratios become difficult to use because the direction of the relationship can actually shift midstream. So when you look at PEG ratios, look at them with caution because it's so easy to misuse. So let's summarize. When you look at PEG ratios, high-risk companies will generally tend to have lower PEG ratios than low-risk companies. It doesn't make them cheap. It just means that they're higher risk. Companies that can attain growth more efficiently, have higher returns on equity, will have higher PEG ratios than companies with lower returns on equity. And companies with very low or very high growth rates, remember that you have that U-shaped curve, will tend to have higher PEG ratios than companies that are towards the middle of your growth rate, an average growth rate. So when you use PEG ratios, keep that in mind because people are sloppy about their use of PEG ratios. So I don't want to bulldoze through here. So if there are any questions, I want to pause for a minute and give people a chance to ask questions. You guys are awfully quiet now. So. No questions? Let's talk about price to book ratios. Remember the little trick we came up with? It's an equity multiple. Go back to an equity discounted cash flow model. Simplest one you can think. Stable growth dividend discount model. And divide both sides by the base of your multiple. Divide both sides by book value. I end up with the equation for a price to book ratio. The price to book ratio in a stable growth dividend discount model is a function of four variables. Return equity, payout ratio, cost of equity, growth rate. Just like PE ratios, we now have the variables we need to control for. And if you do the simplification, you can actually simplify. So if you're using next year's earnings, then you can get rid of even the 1+U. In fact, I'm going to make this equation even simpler. Remember that growth in a fundamental growth equation can be written as 1 minus the payout ratio times return equity. If I plug that back into the previous page where we have the payout ratio, I end up with a simplified version of the price to book ratio. Hang in there with me. The price to book ratio for a firm can actually be written as return on equity minus the growth rate in the numerator and cost of equity minus the growth rate in the denominator. Take a look at that equation. Let me ask you a question. You have G and the growth in both the numerator and the denominator. What has to be true for a stock to trade at book value? What should be true about your return equity and your cost of equity? If your return equity
is the same,
if they're equal, then your price to book ratio is going to be equal. And when your return on equity is consistently lower than your cost of equity, what should you expect the stock to do? Trade at below book value, right? And if your return equity is much higher than the cost of equity, you trade much at a multiple of book value, 3 times, 5 times, 7 times book value. You take a company like Apple, or you take a company like Microsoft. Microsoft, I think, trades at 12 times book value. But its return equity is like 60%. In contrast, AT&T trades at close to book value. Why? Because its return equity is close to its cost of equity. And there are banks that trade it below their book value. Why? Because the return equity is less than the cost of equity. It's the magic ingredient. Whenever somebody says a stock is cheap because it has a low price to book ratio, the question you always need to ask them is, what's your return equity? Every multiple has what I call a companion variable. It's the one number you need to know to use that multiple well. With price to book, that number is return equity. Any questions about price to book and return equity? Now, since we've done price to book, might as well do its close relative. Price to book, I take market value of equity and divide by book value of equity, right? But I could do a version of the multiple that is at the enterprise value level. So in the numerator, instead of using market value of equity, what if I used EV, enterprise value? And in the denominator, instead of using the book value of equity, I use book value of invested capital. This is called EV to invested capital. So just like price to book, it's the analog for the whole firm. You're dividing the enterprise value by the invested capital. You know what drives it? Return on capital minus the growth rate divided by. So compare the two equations. They're actually very similar, right? Instead of market value of equity, I use market value of the entire firm's operating assets, enterprise value. So book value of equity, I use book value of the invested capital. So return on equity, I use return on capital. So cost of equity, I use cost of capital. But the same relationship applies. If your return on capital is roughly equal to the cost of capital, your enterprise value should be roughly equal to invested capital. If your return on capital is less than your cost of capital, then you should expect your company to trade it below invested capital. And if it's greater, you should expect it to trade at a premium. So that is why we do these equations. It's not as a different way of estimating the multiple. That's pointless because you're getting an intrinsic value for your company and you've already done that. It's more to get a sense of what are the variables that I should be controlling for when I use a specific multiple. So let me move towards a final multiple. Let's talk about EV to EBITDA. As I said, I think it was earlier in the class, I mentioned that EV to EBITDA was a multiple that I almost never saw in 1986 when I first started looking at equity research reports. Today, about a third of all equity research is driven by EV to EBITDA. So I wanted to ask a question, what is it that drives EV to EBITDA multiples? So I did the standard technique. I went back to an enterprise value model, free cash flow to the firm, divided by cost of capital minus growth rate, stable growth, firm valuation. I broke down free cash flow to the firm into EBIT times 1 minus D. This is just a fancy way of writing EBIT times 1 minus D because I wanted EBITDA on the right-hand side. Plus depreciation, minus capex, minus change. So that's free cash flow to the firm, just broken out, divided by cost of capital minus the growth rate. I divide both sides of the equation by EBITDA. And when I do that, I get an equation for EV to EBITDA. And the EV to EBITDA multiple for a firm is a function of the following variables. First, the tax rate. You're saying, why do tax rates matter? EBITDA is before interest, taxes, and depreciation. Let's take a limiting case. Let's suppose you operate in an economy where the tax rate is 100%. In other words, government takes away all your earnings. What multiple of EBITDA would you pay in that company, for that company? If your tax rate is 100%, what multiple of EBITDA should you pay? I would say zero. If government's going to take away all your money, why are you paying? And if the tax rate is 0%, you'll be willing to pay more. So the tax rate matters. The cost of capital and the growth rate matter. The higher your cost of capital, you're an emerging market telecom company, you should trade at a lower multiple of EBITDA than if you're a developed market telecom company. If you're a high growth telecom company, you should trade at a higher multiple of EBITDA. And see these three variables in the end? They consolidated, basically capex, depreciation, working capital consolidated as your reinvestment. Holding all else constant, if your company has a low reinvestment rate or a high return on capital, you'd expect it to trade at a much higher EV to EBITDA. So you want to play the game? You want to find a cheap stock based on EV to EBITDA. Somebody help me out. You want a low EV to EBITDA, right? First thing you're looking for. On tax rate, do you want a low tax rate or a high tax rate? I want somebody to unmute themselves and talk because everything happening in the chat. Go ahead, Chen. Do you want a low tax rate or a high tax rate?
A low tax rate, and then high growth, and low cost.
You want low tax rate, high growth, and what return on capital?
Low.
Low or high?
Oh, but cost of capital low, but return on capital.
Cost of capital low, return on capital high. So you want a company with low EV to EBITDA, low tax rate, because a high tax rate will explain away the low EV to EBITDA. So you want low tax rate, you want high growth, low cost of capital, and a high return on capital. Amazing. What chance do I have finding it? Keep looking. You've, in a sense, caught on to what most portfolio managers do, and they don't do it very well. They screen stocks. And when you screen stocks, you're saying, what screen should I use? you've got the basis for the screens if you can do the algebra. Any questions on what we've done here?
Professor?
Yes.
About the price to book ratio, do you not use it for high growth firms? Do you mostly keep it for stable growth?
No, you can use it for anyone. The equation I've stuck with is a stable growth equation because algebraically it's easier to work with. But just because of high growth firm, the relationship will still apply, right? Higher returns on equity would still translate into higher price to book ratios. So if I have two high growth firms and one has a much higher return on equity than the other, I would expect the company with a higher return on equity to trade an even higher multiple of book value than the one with the lower return equity. And it's a multiplier effect, actually. So if you have a high return equity and you have high growth, the multiplier of book value you're going to trade at is going to be huge. I mean, take a look at Zoom's price to book now. I think it's like 100. And people are, they're saying, they're befuddled. So what's going on here? Well, Zoom to begin with might be a little overvalued, but some of it is this multiplier effect of having a high return on equity on top of a high growth rate.
But what if it's a young firm and you don't really see much?
The money losing company, it's expected return on equity that should drive your price to book, right? It's not last year's return equity that's driving these equations. It's expected future return equity. So when you pick the target margin for your company, you're also picking a return on equity that goes with that target margin. So so when you look at these valuation equations, there's an ROE in here, but it's not last year's ROE necessarily, it's some future ROE then.
Got it, thank you.
Chen?
I have a question. So do these still apply for companies with commodity exposure? Because when commodity comes in, the growth and the current multiple can be inflated.
Yeah. Are you saying, can I use this for an oil company? Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
The thing is, the EBITDA that you might be using for your scaling might not be last year's EBITDA because it's not fair to scale enterprise value to last year's number. Last year's oil price might have been 100, it might have been 20. So you know what people use when they use multiples for commodity companies? They use a normalized EBITDA or a normalized return on equity, where they normalize across the cycle. And they look at what the average earnings the oil company earned across 10 years instead of last year's earnings. The only problem is we don't know whether we'll go back to the average over the last 10 years. So there's a danger there even, but that's what they usually do.
Got it. Thank you.
Okay. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take a hypothetical company. Again, I'm going to do that exercise with PE and PEG and just keep the company simple and try to change variables. So this is a company with a 36% tax rate. CapEx is 30% of EBITDA. Depreciation is 20% of EBITDA. So the net CapEx is 10% of EBITDA. Cost of capital is 10%. Let's assume the firm is no working capitalist to keep our lives simple and that it's in stable growth, going 5% a year forever. I'm going to compute an intrinsic enterprise value to EBITDA. Intrinsic because I'm using a two-stage dividend discount model to get this equation. I go in and plug in the numbers. 36% tax rate, 10% cost of capital, 5% growth rate. There's the depreciation, there's the CapEx. I come up with a value of 8.24. You're saying, what does that tell me? If this company were trading at fair value, it should be trading at about 8.24 times EBITDA. Well, then you're saying, what do you do with that? Well, I want to change variables and see what happens at EBITDA. So here's the three what ifs asked. I said, holding all its constant, what will happen to my EV to EBITDA if my tax rate changes? Remember, the 8.24 was with the 36% tax rate. This same company, the 0% tax rate, would trade at 14 times EBITDA, not 8.24 times EBITDA. And with a 50% tax rate, would trade at less than 6 times EBITDA. You say, who really cares? Let's say that you're the airline analyst for Europe. Okay? So you're an equity research analyst for Europe and your sector is European Airlines. So who's in your group? You've got Ryanair, you've got EasyJet, you've got Lufthansa, you've got Swissair, I don't know, 11 European Airlines. And you're comparing EV to EBITDA across the companies. Keeping in mind that tax rates vary across Europe, you know who might end up looking expensive to you every time you look across EV to EBITDA? Which European country has the lowest tax rate? Anybody know? It's Ireland with a 12% tax rate. Ryanair is an Irish company. So guess what? When you have a 12% tax rate, your multiple of EBITDA is going to be much higher. Doesn't make you an expensive company. So Ryanair always looks expensive on an EV to EBITDA basis because its tax rates are lower. So when you think about tax rates, that's the reason you think about tax rates. When you compare companies, you want to make sure that the tax rates you're comparing are also brought into the comparison. I also looked at what will happen to EV to EBITDA as I increase my reinvestment. Holding my growth constant, that's critical. If I increase my reinvestment, I'm getting less efficient about the way I deliver growth. My EV to EBITDA multiples get lower. So when you look at infrastructure companies, often they traded abysmal EV to EBITDA multiples. You know what infrastructure companies are, toll road companies, steel companies. And the reason is very simple. Not only do they have to reinvest a lot, and these businesses are reinvesting a lot, their growth rates have dropped at the same time. So they get this very toxic combination of low growth and high reinvestment, shows up as lower EV to EBITDA multiples. And finally, I looked at what would happen to the EV to EBITDA if I kept my cost of capital fixed and increased my return on capital. No surprises here. As my return on capital goes up, my EV to EBITDA goes up. You see why this is useful. Let's say you've graduated, you moved up the ranks, you're now the CFO of a company, and I'm a banker, and I'm trying to get you to do an acquisition. So I call you and I say, hey, you know what? We found this incredibly cheap stock for you. It's trading at 4.5 times EBITDA. Sounds cheap, right? 4.5 times EBITDA. But before you jump at the chance, you should be asking questions. Like what? What's the tax rate this company faced last year? Maybe it's in a part of the world where they have an 80% tax rate. Unlikely, but you want to find out. Second, you would ask, what kind of growth did it have last year? My guess is if it's trading at 4.5 times EBITDA, it's growing at 1%, maybe 0.5%. Third, you can ask, what kind of return on capital did this company have last year? And guess what? If it is trading at 4.5 times EBITDA, its return on capital is probably down in the floor, 3%. What kind of cost of capital? Maybe it's emerging market. Maybe it's a Lebanese steel company, 25% cost of capital. The point I'm raising is lots of companies look cheap. Most companies that look cheap deserve to be cheap. And what you're trying to do when you're pricing is separate those companies that are actually cheap from the ones that look cheap. And what we're setting up is a process for asking the right questions. Any questions about... There are none. I'm going to do one final multiple and then we'll close the books on this part of the pricing process. I want to look at what multiple of revenues companies trade at, because this has become a widely used multiple, especially in sectors where companies lose money. So to look at EV to sales, I did exactly the same process. I went back to DCF model and an enterprise value model. I did the algebra and ended up with an equation. So here's the equation for a two-stage model with EV to sales. And it looks complicated, but look at the variable that's popped up that wasn't there before. See what it is? Operating margin. Remember I said every multiple is a companion variable? The companion variable for EV to sales is operating margin. If you have a high operating margin, you trade at a high multiple of sales. If you have a low operating margin, you trade at a low multiple of sales. And EV to sales, unlike the other multiples, you know, you don't expect good companies to necessarily have high EV to sales and bad companies to have low EV to sales, because it depends on your business model. Let me explain. Walmart has a much lower EV to sales ratio than Bed Bath & Beyond. That should surprise you, right? Because Walmart is a much healthier company than Bed Bath & Beyond. So why does Walmart trade a lower multiple of revenues than Bed Bath & Beyond? What is it about Walmart's model that might lead to a low multiple of revenues? It's low prices, high volume, and low margins, right? It's a low margin, it's a discount retail. It should trade a low multiple of revenues, but you know what saves Walmart? How much revenues did they have last year? Does anybody know? What were Walmart's revenues last year?
$10 billion.
$500 billion. A half a trillion. So even if you traded 0.6 times revenues, that's $300 billion. So that's why EV to sales is a little deceptive, because higher is better than lower. It depends on your business model. Bed Bath & Beyond has a high multiple of sales, but guess what? They have so little in sales, and who cares if you trade at 3x sales? So when you look at EV to sales, you've got to look past the number to what kind of business model. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to use the EV to sales ratio to answer a question that every marketing person seems to want to answer, which is, what's a valuable brand name, right? When you have companies that claim to have brand names, they all want you to pay a premium for the brand name. The question is, what's the value of a brand name? And I think I brought this up very early in the class, but I'll bring it up again. Let's see if you remember. What is the value of a brand name? What is the advantage that a company has when it has a strong brand name? Rodrigo?
They can charge.
I can't hear you very well. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Now you're completely muted. Chen, go ahead. Sorry, Rodrigo. Your mic has some issues. Chen?
I think one thing is you can charge a premium to customers and you can sell more in volume and your sale will be more steady in terms of.
You want a triple whammy, but at the minimum, you should be able to charge a higher price for exactly the same product, right?
Yeah.
That's basically what it is. And I don't know whether I gave you this example, but I'll give it to you again anyway. I think if you want to see brand name value at play, all you have to do is walk into a pharmacy and check out the painkiller aisle. Check for the aspirin. So you don't have to go ask the pharmacist for this. It's over the counter. Check the different aspirin makers, right? You've got Bayer aspirin, and right next to it, you'll have a generic aspirin, the CVS aspirin. Are there any differences between the generic and the brand name aspirins? You look at the ingredients, it's exactly the same. It's been off patent for 100 years, but the Bayer aspirin sells at twice the price of the CVS aspirin. Same thing with Sudafed, or if you have allergies, every allergy medicine that's over the counter, there's a generic version. There's the brand name version. The brand name version sells at a higher price. That's pure brand name power. So if you have brand name power, you get to charge higher prices. If you have higher prices, you're going to have higher margins. And if you go down the Chen route, you could even have higher sales and lower cost of capital. Do you see where I'm going? To value a brand name, here's what I will need to do. I will need to value the company with the brand name. And then I have to do a second valuation where I ask a hypothetical. What will happen to this company if it loses its brand name? So let me tell you a story. So about 15 years ago, a student of mine calls. He was working at Coca-Cola, pretty high up in the ranks. So he called me from Atlanta and he said, can you come in and talk to our top management about Coca-Cola's brand name? Because we all know brand name is our biggest asset and we want to know how to value it. So I said, sure. So I walked into a room full of Coca-Cola executives, you know, top marketing guy, top production guy, top brand name guy, top finance guy. And I did a traditional DCF valuation of Coca-Cola. So I won't go through the specifics, but I gave them a high return on capital, a high growth rate. And essentially, I came up with a value of about $80 billion. So I finished the valuation. Guy in the front row puts up his hand, head marketing honcho, and he said, you forgot something very important. And I'm trying to think of what did I forget. Maybe I forgot a division, maybe a business. I said, what did I forget? He said, you forgot the fact that Coca-Cola has the most valuable brand name in the world. I said, okay, so what exactly do you want me to do? He said, you should add at least a 20% premium to your valuation. And I said, why? He said, because that's what we do at Coca-Cola, is when we buy brand name companies in other countries, we value them and then we add a 20% premium. And I said, just because you do stupid things doesn't mean I have to do stupid things too. And he said, hey, don't you think that Coca-Cola's brand name is worth a lot? I said, absolutely. It's the only thing in this building that's worth anything because nothing else you do is really adding that much value. He said, why aren't you adding a premium? You know what my answer was? Because it's already in there. He said, where? I said, everywhere. Why do you think you earn a 21% return on capital? You think it's got anything to do with the taste now? It's your brand name. What that return on capital translates into a high growth rate. In fact, everything you do as a company is being affected by a brand name. So when I use those numbers, I'm already reflecting the brand name. He said, I don't believe you. Luckily, I came prepared and I got lucky. So I asked a hypothetical question. What would happen tomorrow if Coca-Cola woke up and its brand name had disappeared? Think of a Twilight Zone episode but nobody recognizes the red can of the words Coca-Cola. Your brand name has disappeared. It's every marketing person's nightmare. Let's make it come true. Let's see what would happen. And here's where I got lucky. I found a Canadian company called COTT, C-O-T-T. It makes generic sodas. It sells almost as many cans of soda as Coca-Cola does. The reason you've never heard of it is it allows supermarkets and grocery stores to put their own generic name on it. So I found COTT, and COTT's margins were 5.28%. Compare that to the Coca-Cola margins, about one third of the margin. I said, tomorrow Coca-Cola wakes up and it's lost its brand name. Its margins are going to look like a generic company's margins. I left all the numbers at Coca-Cola numbers, same revenues, same cost of capital, which actually I'm bending over backwards here. It's a microcosm. It's conceivable that if you're a Coca-Cola and you go into a bank in Atlanta, that you're getting a lower cost of debt because you're Coca-Cola. I'm keeping the cost of capital and revenues the same, and I'm changing the margin. But when I change the margin, it has a ripple effect. It lowers my return on capital. If it lowers my return on capital, it lowers my growth rate. And if I travel all the way down, the value that I get for Coca-Cola with COTT's margins is $15.37 billion. You want me to give Coca-Cola a brand name premium? I just did. I gave them a $64 billion premium. If you don't think that's enough, tell me why. But don't ask me to add a 20% premium. There used to be this old ad, and no, it's no longer on. Probably you can find it on YouTube, for a spaghetti sauce called Ragu. And so I remember watching this ad about 30 years ago. Here's how the ad begins. It begins with this 40-year-old Italian man going back to his mom's house for dinner. Big time loser, because it's obvious that he's going back to his mother's house for dinner pretty much every night. So he walks into the house, his mother's in the kitchen, stirring a big pot of spaghetti sauce, surrounded by empty bottles of Ragu spaghetti sauce. And he says, "Mom, what are you doing?" And she says, "I'm making spaghetti sauce for you." And she said, but he says, "Look, you know, you're making spaghetti sauce from a bottle. You always used to make it from scratch," which her reaction should be, "If you didn't show up for dinner every night, I might make it from scratch." And then he says, but then he starts listing off the ingredients. "But does this ragu spaghetti sauce have tomatoes? Let me start with the obvious one. Does it have oregano? Does it have cayenne? I'm Indian. I throw in cayenne into everything." And that's it. And her response to everything he has is, "It's already in there." If you do a good valuation, your response should be like that guy's mother. He says, where's the brand name? It's in there. Where's the great management? It's in there. Good discounted cash flow valuation. Everything should already be in there. There's no garnishing after the fact. It's already embedded in there. So brand name value, can I value it? Absolutely. Now, it's easier to do with Coca-Cola than with Apple. Do you see why? Coca-Cola has only one competitive advantage. Laura, I'll come to you. Coca-Cola has only one competitive advantage. It's brand name. When I look at an Apple, it's in addition to its brand name, it's got an operating system, it's got technology, it's got styling. So what I'm capturing here is actually the value of all of your competitive advantages. And this is why I'm a little bit of a cynic when it comes to accountants trying to slice and dice this number. Is with Coca-Cola, it might be doable, but I don't think you should be doing it with Apple because it's very messy. Laura, what's your question?
So when you're considering valuing a company's brand name, what if they're not like the number one company in that industry, but they're a close runner up?
Here's what you can do, because you don't compare it to the first company, right? You're comparing it to a generic company. So the first thing I'm looking for, let's say you take a beverage company. Yeah. Coca-Cola is number one, Pepsi is number two, but Pepsi's margins are like 14%. I would still get a brand name value for Pepsi with a 14% margin. It'd just be lower than the brand name for Coca-Cola.
Okay.
RC Cola's is 10.5%. That's still higher than the 5%. So it'll be a gradation of brand name values before I get down to zero.
Uh-huh.
You see what I'm saying? It's not just the best company. It's every company with margins. In fact, if I cannot find a generic company, what I would do is I would use the average margin for the sector. So many of you are valuing, let's say, I think somebody's valuing Monster Beverages. If you want to value the brand name in Monster Beverages, you can take the value Monster Beverages as is and then replace your target margin with just the industry average margin. It's very rough and approximate, but you get a value for Monster Beverages brand name. Did I answer your question, Laura?
Yes, I'm just, because I'm talking about my company specifically, and I'm doing Lyft, so I was wondering, because it's not obviously Uber, you know what I mean?
Think right now, assessing a brand name for a ride-sharing company, I'm not sure brand, I don't think brand is a competitive advantage in ride-sharing, and I'll tell you why.
I feel like for Uber it is, because...
Is it? Wait, Laura, would you pay a premium to take an Uber car over a Lyft car?
No, I actually wouldn't, but some people would.
And I think that's why when Uber talks about its competitive advantages, remember, brand name is not the... Uber's competitive advantage is they have more cars and more drivers. And that's a big competitive advantage in ride sharing because you have more cars closer to anybody. So what I do when I have to look for a car, I don't use ride shares that much, is I have both Uber and Lyft installed on my phone. I actually have Uber, I have Lyft, I have Grab because I'm all over the world. So I check my Uber ride and then the Lyft ride, and then I always pick the cheaper one. Right. Which tells me that if there's brand name, it's not formed yet. Both companies are trying to create brand name by doing what? By trying to get a reputation for being reliable, And one of the problems with Uber is they keep getting in their own way, right? Because for every step forward they make towards brand name, then they have an incident with a driver somewhere So this is an ongoing process. So it's going to be kind of fun to watch these two companies and Didi in China and Grab in Malaysia and Ola try to create a brand name, because right now it's a commodity business.
Right.
You know what I mean by commodity? And that's why they don't make money. It's become commoditized. They've somehow got to get away from it being a commodity business. It's going to be tough to do though, but I think that's what they're working on.
All right. Thank you.
Will ask, firms with bad reputation, should you penalize them? Haven't you penalized them already in your DCF? Did you give them a lower return? I mean, if you haven't penalized them, I think you should. In fact, I have a paper on ESG. You know what ESG is? This buzzword right now, environment, social, governance, all the corporate governance stuff. I think it's whole thing is I think made up crap for people wanting to get rich off of buzzwords. So I have a paper in ESG where I talk about how do you value a reputation? How do you value the fact that you're a good company or a company that does things environmentally well? So if you get a chance, go to my website. It's right on the front page. Click on it. It's an easy paper to read. It's only about 20 pages, but it lays out a framework for valuing reputation and bring it into your DCF. Okay, so let's summarize. You give me any multiple, what's the first thing I do? I look to see what drives that multiple. By going back to a DCF model, if it's an equity multiple, price to dividends, price to earnings, price to book, price to sales, I go back to a stable growth dividend discount model. And I end up with what the variables are that drive that multiple. So you can see with each one, with dividend yield, with price earnings, with price to book, I'm listing out the variables that affect that multiple and therefore I need to control for. If you're looking at an enterprise value multiple, and we looked at EV to sales and EV to EBITDA already, but you can look at other variants. Again, I'm going to go back to a discounted cash flow model, but this time an enterprise value DCF model. And I'm going to come up with the drivers of this multiple. This is a key step in pricing. Is if you just think of pricing as lowest PE ratio, lowest price to book, you're going to be buying a lot of crappy companies that look cheap but deserve to be cheap. U.S. For Cart, right? It's not Cart. Basically, it's Coca-Cola with Cart's margin. So don't think of this as Coca-Cola versus Cart. It's Coca-Cola where only the margins have been changed, reflect the fact that it has lost its brand name. Because valuing Coca-Cola versus Cart, I'm going to get two different values. They're two different companies. So what you're doing is you're taking your company and you're asking a what if question, which is, what if I lose my brand name? And if you lose your brand name, I'm assuming that the only thing that affected is the margin, and everything else about your company stays as is. So now let's talk about applying the multiples. We've defined, we've described, we've analyzed, we're now ready to apply. So when I get ready to apply, the first thing I've got to find is comparable firms. And if you look at the way this is practiced out there on the street in equity research, the way we define comparable firms, we always look at other companies in the same sector. So if I ask you to price a steel company, you pull up other steel companies. If I ask you to price a beverage company, you pull up other beverage companies. I can understand why people do that. It's a shortcut. But from a valuation perspective, if you think about a similar company is a company with similar cash flows, similar growth, and similar risk, right? That's it. There's nowhere in there does it say it has to be the same sector. And I'll tell you where it plays out. If I ask you to price Microsoft and you pull up other software companies, what other software company in the world is even remotely like Microsoft? Maybe to price Microsoft, I should be looking at other companies that dominate their businesses, have huge margins and lots of cash flows, which might be companies in five other businesses. So maybe we need to start to rethink what we mean by comparable. And second, even if you're careful about picking comparable companies, you're still going to find differences across companies. On what? On growth, on risk, on payout, on return equity. Any kinds of stood stories. You've got to find a way to control for these differences. I've kind of opened the door to how I do that by showing you the regression approach. But the next phase of this class, I'm going to be using statistics fairly liberally. And not high-level statistics, but very simple statistics. So let's start with the question of what company should I use as my comparables? Now, when you sit down to price your company, that's the next phase of your project. Now, let's say Laura has to price Lyft. She can define comparable companies as other ride-sharing companies. And Laura, if you define as other ride-sharing companies, how many companies will you have in your comparable list?
Probably like 4 or 5.
Will you even have 4 or 5? Because remember, 3 of those are not traded.
Oh, I think it's only 2, actually. I'm pretty sure it's Lyft and Uber.
That's basically it. So you're going to go up to price Lyft, you've got to use Uber. If you define comparable narrowly, you're not going to be able to do much pricing because all you can do is price Lyft against Uber and Uber against Lyft.
Right.
So first choice you have to make is, do I want to go with a small sample of companies just like mine, which for you will mean just 2 companies in your sample, or should I define this as a much broader business, maybe transportation or a subset of it where I can give 15 or 20 companies in my sample? My advice is try to get a larger sample, and it's going to be tricky because you've got to make subjective judgments about what to include in that. You might include mass transit companies that are publicly traded. You might use bus companies like Greyhound in there. You're saying they're not comparable? I'll give you a way to control for differences. But when you do pricing and you price based on a really small sample, you always run the risk of just overpricing the companies because you're just comparing them against each other. For a long time, Uber was priced against Lyft and Lyft was priced against Uber, but nobody stopped and asked the question, are they both overpriced, right? Because that can happen. So the first choice we have to make is small samples of companies just like yours are larger samples. And my statistical side says go for a larger sample. Second, you've got to control for differences across your companies. Even between Uber and Lyft, there are differences, right? One is Uber is a global car service company. Lyft is just US car service. Uber has other businesses like Uber Freight and Uber Eats. Lyft is just car service. Uber is in more US cities than Lyft is. So already you can see, even with those two companies that we think of as very similar companies, there are differences. And you have to ask yourself, how will those differences play out in the pricing of these two companies? The problem is, if you have a direct comparison like Uber and Lyft, you can just talk about those two companies. But what if you have a dozen companies? Storytelling very quickly runs you into a rock because you keep going back and forth. So there are two tactics you can adopt. One is you can try to bring that variable that you think matters into your multiple. I'll give you an example of how this would play out in ride-sharing. I hate to make Laura's project the project for the class, but Uber and Lyft are perfect.
No, this is awesome. Thank you. I really appreciate this.
Laura, what do you want to scale the enterprise value of Uber and Lyft to? Because earnings clearly don't work. They're both losing money. You could do it to revenues, right?
Yeah.
Could you do it to riders? Because they both report riders.
I guess so, yeah.
You could do it to drivers, right?
Yeah.
In a sense, you could do it to cities. What I'm saying is that the possibilities are kind of endless. You see, which one should I pick? And I think it depends on what you think best captures their potential for value. If you think the best measure for capturing potential value is the number of riders they have, because that's the platform they're building on, enterprise value to rider is what you might use. But you're bringing the riders into your equation by dividing the enterprise value by the number of riders. That's what I mean by a modified multiple. Or you can say, look, I'm going to look at EV to sales, but I'm going to control for how many cities there are and how many riders you have. And that's where statistical techniques can help. So let's say I find 15 transport. I'm sorry, go ahead, Laura.
how do you take out all the stuff that Uber does that Lyft doesn't do? How do you account for that?
It's going to be really difficult to do. So in a sense, that's where the storytelling part, you got to decide whether the rest of Uber's businesses are pulling up its multiple or pulling down its multiple. Do you see what I mean by that? Uber yeah. Freight, for instance, brings something into revenues. It also brings something into the enterprise value. And we have no idea how much that is.
Right.
That's why Uber versus Lyft, you're going to run into that wall of it. You're going to come to a point where you say, I think Uber is cheaper, but.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, with only a sample of two, it's going to be difficult to answer that question. Whereas if you had a sample of 15, you might be able to address those questions because you have more data from more companies to try to address it. But Uber versus Lyft, you can do only so much. And you know, and if that's all you can do, that's all you can do. Your pricing might be just as pricing across two companies. And incidentally, if you want to bring in Didi, Ola, and Grab, you'd have to use a VC pricing for those companies because that you can pull up. If you go online, you can check what the latest pricing was for Didi, Grab, and Ola. That'll bring your sample size at least to 5.
Okay.
And that might give you a little more leeway in the comparison, but I think you've got to bring in some statistics to control for those differences.
Right. Yeah. Thank you.
So let's try a couple more examples. I'm going to play the role of the beverage analyst. And these are my companies in my sector. So you see all the way from Coca-Cola to Hanson. It's an old sample. So don't think the numbers are nothing like the numbers you see today. So what I've reported is the trailing PE for these companies. And I also have the expected growth in earnings for the next 5 years and the standard deviation in stock prices for each company. They say, why are you giving me this information? I'm going to play the role of a naive equity research analyst. And I want you to cut me down and tell me what I'm missing when I send out this recommendation. I'm going to send out a buy recommendation on three stocks, Hanson Natural, André Wine, and Todd Hunter International. You know what Hanson produces, right? It's this fruity sodas. It's, André Wine makes the champagne so cheap that looking at it gives you a headache. You see the ads only during Christmas. Todd Hunter, I have no idea what they do. You know why I picked these three companies? Why am I putting buys on these companies? Remember, I'm a naive equity research analyst. So why am I picking these three companies?
They have a low PE ratio.
Low PE ratio. So push back. So tell me what I might be missing that might explain the low PE. Let's start with André Wine and Todd Hunter. What is it that explains the low PE at those companies? Low growth, right? And Hanson Natural looks good, right? It's got a 17% growth. But there, what's my concern? High risk. You guys have it. That's exactly what pricing is. And the problem is if I just leave it there, you're going to say, you know, what next? I'm going to come back with the way you tie up the knots because already you can see, and you can pick up equity research reports, and you'll see equity research analysts make this kind of mistake over and over again. The stock is cheap, but they haven't even bothered test checking the numbers that need to be checked, growth and risk. So when I say André Wine and Hanson Natural are undervalued, I'm missing the fact that one company is really low growth and the other company is really high risk. I'll come back, as I said, to that beverage example in a little while. Let's take a second example. This was in the 1990s when a lot of emerging market telecom companies were privatizing and going public. So I'm now the emerging market, I'm actually the telecom analyst in the US, and this is my sector. So again, I'm gonna put out buy recommendations on two companies. And I want you to tell me again what I'm missing, and it's pretty obvious. And then we're going to talk about a way in which I can control for what I'm missing. The two companies I'm going to put a buy order on are Indosat, which was the Indonesian telecom company then, and Telebras, which at that time was the Brazilian telecom company. It's since been broken up into seven telecom companies. Why? Because they have really low PE ratios. But you see the problem, right? They have really low PE ratios, but they also had
low growth.
But in addition, there's another factor here. Remember, these are the late 1990s when emerging market companies were really, really risky and developed market companies were much safer on a relative basis. If you look at the sector, I have Deutsche Telekom and Danish Telecom in the sample, in addition to Telebras and Indosat. So in addition to lower growth, Indosat and Telebras happen to be in very risky emerging markets. So two worries, right? Low growth and high risk. I can tell you stories, but I'm going to walk, you know, dance myself into a corner. So here's what I did. I opened up my statistics book. I said, look, I have PE ratios across telecom companies. I'm worried about two things. One is what the growth rate is, and the second is whether these companies are emerging market and developed market companies. So the growth rate, I actually use the growth rate. For the emerging market companies, I used a dummy variable. You know what a dummy variable is? It takes on a value of either 0 or 1. I set it to 1 if it was an emerging market telecom company and 0 if it was not. And I ran a regression. The R-squared I got was 66%. I forgot to ask you this. Is a R-squared of 66% a good R-squared?
Nope.
I think statistics classes ruin you for life, because in statistics classes, you get R-squares of 95% for everything you do. It's because you test things not worth testing, like, you know, what is the relationship between how much you eat and how much you weigh? Oh, they're very highly related. Or how much you drink and what your GPA is, they're negatively correlated. In the real world, 66% is as good as it gets. So I'm pretty happy. In fact, the T statistics are what you should focus on. So when you run these regressions for your company, please don't ask yourself, what's a good R-squared? Look at the T statistics. If they're greater than 2, you have significance, you can use the regression. You'll have a much bigger range if you have a lower R-squared, but that's what it is. So let's read this regression. 13.11 is the intercept. That's the base. Every 1% increase in growth at telecom companies in the late 90s increases my PE ratio by 1.21. So higher growth means higher PE. So if your growth rate is 5% higher than mine, your PE ratio is going to be roughly 6 higher than mine, 5 times 1.21. And if you're an emerging market company, your PE ratio, holding all else constant, will be 13.85 lower than a developed market company. So if two companies, exactly the same growth rate, the emerging market company will have a much lower PE ratio. Chen?
But wouldn't it not be like a linear regression, because growth rate is on the
top? In fact, that's a nice thing, is I've left these regressions very basic. The better you get at statistics, the more you can do with the data. Because, you know, Chen is raising a very interesting point. This is called a linear regression. And the relationship between PE and growth might not be linear. So when the relationship is nonlinear, there are ways in statistics you can fix it. You can run nonlinear regressions, we can transform the variables. And I'll come back and talk a little bit about transformations. But I've kept it simple simply because, you know, statistics already is a foreign language for most of us. I don't want to hit you with nonlinear regressions. But I want to, what I'm trying to point out is, let's use the statistics toolkit rather than just telling stories. So here's what I did. I took Telebrass. Look cheap, right? I plugged in Telebrass's PE ratio, growth rate, 7.5%, and the fact was an emerging market company into the regression. I got a predicted PE for Telebrass of 8.35. It's trading at 8.9 times earnings. It looked cheap, but after I control for its low growth and high risk, it's actually expensive relative to other telecom companies. I'm not saying you should replace intuition with regressions, but regression should be part of your toolkit. You're an equity research analyst. You're comparing PE ratios across 15 companies, and you're looking at different growth rates. Stop telling stories. Look to see whether there's a link between the two, and see if statistically your story has a basis, because otherwise you're on very, very, very loose ground. One final exercise, and then we'll end for today. So I was the beverage analyst and I got fired for my recommendation. Then I became the emerging market telecom analyst and I got fired for my recommendation. But I landed on my feet. I'm now the European banking analyst, and it's 2010. I look at banks and I look at their price to book ratio, very widely used metric for banks. But I've also given you the return on equity at banks and the standard deviation in stock prices. Okay. What are you looking for? You're looking for mismatches, right? So if you're looking for a cheap stock, tell me what combination you want for price to book, return, equity, and standard deviation. On price to book, if you're looking for a cheap stock, you want low or high? You want low. Okay, good. For return equity, if you're looking for a cheap stock, something that is trading at well below, you want a high return equity. And for standard deviation, you want low or high? Low. You want low. So basically, you want low price to book, high return equity, low standard deviation. Okay. Well, I'll give you one way in which you can eyeball the data. You can compute the median values for each, and here's what you can look for. You can look for stocks that trade at a price to book ratio less than the median for the sector, but have returns in equity and standard returns in equity that are higher than the median and standard deviation that are lower. In other words, you use the median as your base. Okay. But you can see already that this can get tiresome if I give you 100 bets. Can you imagine eyeballing the data of which is higher, which is lower? So I'll give you the other thing I did. And this is going to be the last thing for today. I took the banks and I ran a regression of price to book against return on equity and standard deviation. First, tell me whether the coefficients make sense. Higher return equity stocks have higher price to book ratios. That makes sense, right? Higher risk stocks have lower price to book ratios. The D statistics pass muster. They're greater than 2. The R squared is 79%. I took this regression, plugged in the returns on equity and standard deviation for every bank. Incidentally, you don't have to use standard deviation or betas as your proxy for risk, because when you're doing pricing, you're not doing intrinsic value. For banks, for instance, I could use regulatory capital ratios if that's what I think is a good proxy for risk instead. But in this case, with this regression, I was able to get predicted price to book ratios for every bank. So this column is just me plugging in the return equity and the standard deviation numbers into this equation, getting a predicted number for each one, and then comparing the actual to the predicted. If you get a negative number, it means your stock is undervalued. If you get a positive number, your stock is overvalued. Again, I'm using the data and what I know about the relationship between the multiple and its, and that's why it's so critical that you do your homework first, figure out the variables that drive the multiple and in which direction, because then you're all set to run this regression. Guess what I'm going to suggest you do, even though I know you don't want to do it? You can finish your project pretty much this weekend. Because what's the next phase of your project? You have to price your company, right? It's much simpler than doing your intrinsic valuation. So go to Capital IQ and download the companies that you think are comparable to yours. My suggestion is you'll have to make some subjective judgments. You have a steel company. Do you want to just look at domestic steel companies, global steel companies? Make your choice. Come up with that list. Compute a few multiples, right? Price. Don't trust the multiples that Capital IQ calculates for you because you have no idea what they're doing. So do it yourself. Price earnings, price to book, EV to EBITDA, whatever you've decided. Have 4 or 5 because you don't know which one works the best until you've tried them all. Try them out. Pick a multiple for your sector and make a pricing judgment. It doesn't have to be the same as your value judgment. You know, you could have found your stock to be undervalued. Your pricing could give you a very different judgment. You're asking a different question. Try to get that done, because if you get that done, you're pretty close to being done on your project, because I'll get your DCFs back, you can fix it, your pricing will be done. All set to go on your final project. So any final questions before I sign off?
Professor, I had a quick question about the determinants of multiple slide.
Yeah.
So
back to the page. You're talking about this one?
Yeah. So for all of them, you're assuming they're constant perpetuities?
No. Wait. The equation is irrelevant. Once I've used the equation and extracted the multiples, I throw away the equation. I never use it again. So I'm glad you asked this question, because if I ask you to compute the PE ratio of your company, I don't want you to go plug numbers into this equation, because if you plug numbers into this equation, you know what you're going to get, right? You're going to get a stable growth dividend discount model for your company. And I don't want that. The only reason I use the equation is once I've got the equation, I can use it to determine what variables matter. So it's an intermediate step to derive the variables. And once I've derived them, I throw the equation out. Because remember what we said with PE ratios, I can make this a multi-stage high growth company. The variables are not going to change. So the nice thing about using a stable growth model is it gives you the variables, and you can now use those variables for a high growth company with 7 stages of growth.
Okay, so you're using these variables, like you can use them either in your regression or just to make...
Exactly. Okay. Or to ask what if, remember I said somebody tries to sell you a stock with a low EV to EBITDA, you have the variables lined up and say, well, or low EV to sales, going to ask them, what's your margin? What's your reinvestment rate? What's your cost of capital? What's your growth rate? If nothing else, it tells you what questions you need to ask when somebody's trying to tell you that something is cheap.
Okay, makes sense. Thank you, Professor.
You're welcome. Any other questions? Okay, so I'm going to wrap up. Now, if you get a chance, I just posted updated equity risk premiums on my blog this morning. So if you go and read the latest post, I have a new picture of what the world looks like in terms of equity risk premiums. I'm also going to send that link to you on the email so you can download the new updated risk premiums and take a look at what they are now relative to what they were at the start of the year. So that's about it. Thank you and have a good rest of the week and stay safe.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.